December is a month of mixed emotions. There's the stress of the holidays, the joys of spending time with family and friends, and taking stock of the year's accomplishments and setting goals for the next. But as we think about what's happened and what's to be done, it can also be a time when we notice what isn't there anymore, as we take a moment to appreciate and celebrate the lives of those who've passed away. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and on today's Central Standard, we take a look at just a few of the many people who've passed away this year, whose lives have made our community better for having been a part of it. That and later in the hour, we want to hear from you about individuals who've made an impact in our community, but haven't necessarily made the headlines. That's coming up right after this news. Lots of things have been accomplished in Kansas City this year, but we have also lost a number of notable individuals who helped shape this city and region. Good morning, I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and on today's Central Standard, we look back and celebrate the lives of some of those who've passed away this year and who've made an impact on our community. Later in the hour, we want to hear from you about those who've passed away this year, but perhaps haven't made the headlines. Who are the unsung heroes of Kansas City for 2013? But first, let's just take a moment to look back at some of the notable people in politics, philosophy, and arts who've passed away. Joining me to help look back at the impact of a few of these individuals is KCUR reporter Laura Spencer. Laura, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So one of those people who passed away was Jim Brothers. Who was Jim Brothers?
Jim Brothers was a sculptor who was based in Lawrence, and he died in August at the age of 72. He grew up in a small town in Kansas in the Flint Hills called Eureka, and when he was growing up, he talked about how art wasn't really viewed as practical, and he was one of the only kids in school who drew, but it was one of his aunts who really encouraged him, and he went on to study art in Oklahoma.
And so how did he, you know, what makes him a notable sculptor?
You know, he dabbled in a lot of different artwork, but he has really become known for his figurative works. You can drive along Broadway past the VFW headquarters, and you'll see one of his works called Citizen Soldier. And it's really his large-scale figurative works that made him kind of someone who is known nationally. He has some pieces, a statue of General Dwight Eisenhower, also a Kansas native. It's on display in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. He contributed to the Korean War Memorial that's on the National Mall, and also he contributed to the National D-Day Memorial in Bedford, and those are sculptures from Omaha Beach.
Across the beach, and Death on the Shore were some of those ones commemorating D-Day. It seems like he did a lot of like male soldiers, you know, very, very big kind of masculine and kind of hero-esque sculptures. Was that something he always did, or was that something he kind of grew into?
That's something that he grew into and just really had a talent for, crafting these really realistic-looking figures. But they were larger-than-life figures. He was interesting, though, because he was someone who had been against the Vietnam War. If you ever met him, he, had kind of longish hair, a scruffy beard. And so he wasn't maybe the artist that you would think of who would depict these soldiers. But that really became kind of a hallmark for him in his career.
Did we ever get to learn about why he was so interested in doing works like that? Or was that just like how he paid for his other artistic pursuits?
I think that, he just received a number of commissions later in his career. I know Paul Durrell with Leopold Gallery was really influential in helping him.
Who we'll be hearing from in just a moment.
Yeah, helping him receive those commissions. But he also, he was a figure in the Lawrence scene. He had founded a band, the Alfred Packer Memorial Band, and he played washboard in that band. So he had a lot of, different interests, but he was, pretty low-key. He wasn't someone, you'd meet him. He was really friendly and just a really great guy, but he wasn't he wasn't as larger than life as some of the people he depicted in his sculptures.
I want to bring in Paul Durrell from Leopold Gallery into the conversation. Good morning, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello?
Yeah, good morning. Paul, can you hear me?
I sure can, Matt. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Quite well, thanks.
Well, I wanted to ask you, how did you first meet Jim Brothers?
In 91, I moved back here from Connecticut, New York, where I'd worked in the art world and the museum business. And then I came back to open a gallery representing only Kansas and Missouri artists, and he was the first artist I met. I met him through a brilliant sculptor in Lawrence named Matt Kirby. And Matt took me out to Jim's Farm, North Lawrence, on a February night in 91, and said, "You're not going to believe this guy's work." And Matt was right. I walked into this beat-up, poorly lit chicken shed, barely heated, because Jim was really broke at the time, and he was working on a figure sculpture, rather small piece, nothing monumental at that time. And I was just knocked out by the raw power in the guy's work, the texture and how it was influenced by Rodin's use of texture, and how sophisticated the work was, and how well Jim could nail the human figure, especially when it came to facial features.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked Jim if he wanted me to rep him. I mean, I didn't have a gallery yet. And they said, "Look, I'm broke. You're broke. Shall I represent you and let's see what happens?" And he said, "Sure, let's go." And so I opened my gallery. He was one of my first artists. And that's when I began landing him all the big monumental commissions that you and Laura were just discussing. Laura, you did a great job discussing his career. It's very thorough.
Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, and Paul, so can you explain to me like how that partnership worked? You would essentially go out and proselytize his work. And we also mentioned that, you know, he seemed to do a lot of these really big kind of masculine figures, also kind of, you know, memorializing some conflict, you know, and violence. And he was kind of also against the Vietnam War. Did you guys ever talk about those kind of things?
All the time. Jim was as anti-war as I am. And even though it's been a part of human history since the beginning of time and probably always will be, but it doesn't mean that you glorify it, in our opinion. Mm-hmm. So I began lending him the commissions. The first major commission I got him was for a monument of Mark Twain for a businessman in Hannibal, who turned out to be less than honorable. So we wound up selling, or I wound up selling, that monument of Mark Twain to the Mark Twain a museum in Hartford, Connecticut, where Twain had his mansion, which is now a museum honoring Twain. Once we had that really massive piece up, and it was brilliantly done, it captured so much of Twain, his humor, his mischief, and his bitterness later in life, because he was very bitter as he got older. So many things had gone wrong as he got older. That allowed me to market Jim as a figurative sculptor of some note, which led to the commission of a monument of Omar Bradley, a five-star general from Missouri who served in World War II.
Hmm.
And then that eventually led to the D-Day Memorial, National D-Day Memorial in Virginia, which introduced us to Stephen Ambrose and Steven Spielberg. Spielberg wound up acquiring a bronze from Jim through us.
Mm.
And then, I mean, I like to tell you, get together with Stephen on Friday nights and have a beer, but it didn't quite work out that way. His people bought the work from our people, which is me and my staff of three people. But it was all cool. You know, it's nice to have a piece in Spielberg's collection. He is a very kind person.
Mm.
And then that led eventually to the commission of the Dwight D. Eisenhower Monument in the Capitol Building in D.C.
And for those who don't know a great deal about art or the challenges of sculpting, what made him so kind of noteworthy and put him above so many others? What's so hard about
his work? He really nailed a figure. He could perfectly capture not just a person's facial features, but their personality, what we call putting the soul in the sculpture. Whether it was Twain or whether it was Eisenhower or some of the busts he did at D-Day, some of the leaders such as Churchill and Roosevelt, Truman, or whether he was interpreting an infantryman on the beach at D-Day, he would always struggle, and I emphasize that word, to put the soul of the figure in that piece. So you're not looking at a figure that merely suggests a human being but seems devoid of human characteristics. He would really work to put all those aspects in, which is communicated through the twists of the torso, how you texture the face as opposed to how you texture the clothing, the look in the eyes, and what are you communicating with the eyes and the facial expression, and avoiding certain mistakes in sculpture, certain roads that it's easy to go down, but that never turn out well. And, of course, rendering face, mouth and eyes. That's among the most difficult, along with hands in figurative art.
When you want to see some of his work here in Kansas City, is Laura mentioned a few, but is there one that you turn to, perhaps even in your own collection, but if I was just a member of the public who really wanted to see some of his work, where could I go and see it?
Well, apart from private collections, several people in Kansas City own smaller works by Jim in private collections. Several law firms do, different corporations and private collectors as well. Apart from that, the largest piece in Kansas City is the one that Laura mentioned at the VFW headquarters at 34th and Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is pretty towering. And there's a whole story behind that that I don't think we have time
to hear. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And beyond that, at the River Market, the very first commission I helped Jim land and negotiate in 92 was at the River Market. It's an interpretation of A Boy and a Dog in bronze. It's a fountain, and it's on the east side of the River Market, on the east side of the Steamboat Arabia.
Well, thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. We really appreciate
you
sharing your stories here this morning.
Jim
Brothers was a Kansas native sculptor, and he passed away this August. Mr. Brothers wasn't the only prominent artist to depart this year. John Mark Eberhardt, a poet and author and regular book doctor here on Up to Date, passed away in March. And Laura, he wasn't always a poet and author, correct?
That's right. I mean, he loved newspapers and worked in newspapers for decades. He studied journalism at the University of Missouri in Columbia and then earned a master's in English at UMKC. But he started at the Star in 1987 and turned to book reviewing and editing from 2000 to 2009. But yeah, he started as a journalist, but then he was really someone who nurtured and encouraged poets and would publish poetry in the Star, and then turned to poetry and published two collections of his own.
And he passed away from cancer, but that wasn't the first time he battled, you know, engaged with cancer, as I understand, other people in his family.
That's right. His mother had experienced cancer, and also his wife. And he wrote, a really touching story about kind of working as a caregiver for his wife who had experienced cancer.
Yeah, and when he wrote about that, was his work typically that personal and open, would you say?
Well, I think that in his poetry, I think he was, some of it was personal and open. But as a, the book review editor, you often don't, as a reviewer, you don't often use your first person voice. So I think mm-hmm. that was a little bit out of character to tell his own experience.
Well, I want to bring in a good friend and colleague, Mark Luce, into the conversation. Mark, good morning. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I understand John Mark had a really wonderful sense of humor, and it was even a little dark at times. He even wrote about that in the Star. Do you have any examples of his humor?
I can do my best. I think of in thinking about John Mark over the last couple of days. The thing that really stands out to me is how many times he actually came and did stuff for me. I remember one in particular. I was teaching a book reviewing class at the University of Kansas. This would have been, early 2000s. And he came to talk to the students, the college kids, about what life as a reviewer was like. And, he commanded the class quite well. And he also, he made it sort of perfectly clear to them that, kids, this is a dying field and there's really no place for book critics anymore. But he did it in a way that was quite funny. I think that between serving on panels with him when he was a librarian, reader's advisor, I think, at the Johnson County Public Library, being with him on the book doctors, those things, he always had a sort of a mordant wit and would routinely drop a little dark nugget on everyone. But that in no way did that sort of show a kind of a mean streak or anything like that. And I think he's more just to be mischievous and have a good time. In fact, mm-hmm. he's really, more than anything I can think of, is quite generous.
And how did you get to know him? What was your relationship with him?
Well, in many, many years ago, 1997 or so, I was working at the Star, editing the preview section, and John Mark was working there, and this was before he took over as book editor. When that job came open, I secretly wanted it, but I certainly wasn't old enough or didn't have the experience. And he took it and, just kind of over the years, hanging out, working for him, being with him on the radio, and then serving on panels either with him or for him, hearing him read at the Writer's Place. Over time we forged a pretty good friendship. And while he had about 10 years on me, he really did serve as a type of mentor figure for me. And I think we both encouraged each other, especially when times were rough. I know that for John Mark, losing his job at the Star, it took some while to get over. Mm. But he got over it and got over it quite well.
Yeah, it sounds like he was just an incredibly generous person with just his knowledge. Were there any lessons you took from him about writing or about the craft of journalism?
I think more than anything, what I took away from John Mark is basically do what you want and don't really worry about what anyone else says. And I think as a journalist, sometimes, especially as a freelancer or even as a poet, at times the rejection can become quite routine and can really get you down. Mm-hmm. But what he suggests is simply is to forge ahead, and I think that's the best way. And people are going to say no, and you can either sit around and mope about it, or you can brush yourself off, get back up, and try something else.
Well, Mark Luce, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We really appreciate you sharing some of your memories.
I appreciate you guys having me.
Yeah, you take care. Have a wonderful day. That was Mark Luce. He was a friend and colleague of John Mark Ebenhart, who passed away this year. We reached out to Ken Ebenhart, John Mark's brother, who said that he couldn't be with us this morning, but he wanted to share this statement in memory of John Mark Ebenhart. His extended family wishes to express their gratitude for the support surrounding his loss after his battle with cancer this past March. The enduring comfort and compassion that has been expressed by his former colleagues at the Johnson County Public Library, the Kansas City Star, and the Writer's Place, and all the people at KCUR has been greatly appreciated. To quote C.S. Lewis, his absence is, quote, like the sky spread out over everything. I'd also like to thank KCUR's arts reporter, Laura Spencer, for joining us and helping us remember some of the artists who've made an impact in our community this year. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Central Standard. We're spending some time this morning remembering some of the folks who've passed away this year, who've made an impact in our community. And we're going to be later in the hour coming back to you, to hear about from you about who's passed away this year, who perhaps didn't make the headlines, but deserves our thanks and recognition, who's made an impact in our community. We're now joined by KCUR Community Engagement Reporter Laura Ziegler. Good morning, Laura.
Morning, Matthew.
And we're here to talk about some of the people in philanthropy that have made an impact in our community. And we want to start with Marion Block. She was not just a native of the Midwest. She was a Kansas City native, correct, Laura?
No, actually, she was born in – I'm sorry. I take that back. She was a Kansas City native. She went to Southwest High School, and she was a Hellsburg. Mm-hmm. So her family is known legendary for their philanthropic activity, and it was clearly in her DNA. She was a graduate, like I say, of Southwest High School and of the University of Missouri. And in 1951, she married Henry Block right out of college, who was not only the love of her life, but her lifelong partner, of course, becoming the largest tax preparer in the country, H&R Block. He and his brother started H&R Block.
And she had it seemed like she had a number of charitable interests throughout the city. Can you list some of those?
She was extremely committed to a number of philanthropies, like you said, and in partnership with Henry. Of course, they endowed the Block School of Management right here at UMKC, the Nelson Atkins Gallery, which has that fabulous new building under their name, and they have donated, not incidentally, their amazing Impressionist painting collection to that gallery. St. Luke's Neurosciences Department. Marianne sadly was diagnosed with a brain tumor some 25 years ago and was under the care of neurologists at St. Luke's and KU Med Center for many, many years. And so she was very out front, as was Henry, in charitable giving to the St. Luke's Neurosciences Department.
Mm. Well, I want to bring in Tom Block, Marianne's son. Tom, good morning and welcome to Central Standard.
Great to be with you, Matt. Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, do you know how your mother and father met?
You know, I do. It was they were fixed up on a date back in 1950. My mom's brother, Jim Helzberg, was engaged to be married, and my mother needed a date for the engagement party. So Jim and my dad were old boyhood friends, and Jim asked my dad, "Will you take my sister to the parties for me?"
What?
That was the beginning.
What a gentleman! What a gentleman, and what a classy lady! And your mother and father really shared this philanthropic interest. And where do you think that came from in both of them?
You know, I think it really started with my dad. You know, H&R Block would never have been successful if it weren't for the people of Kansas City, and he felt a great debt to this community. And my mother shared that. And so, as they grew older, they became much more passionate about giving back and really paying off this debt to Kansas City. Mm. And they found that the more they did, the more they enjoyed it. I think they felt that they were getting more out of it than anybody else. And so it was really a, wonderful opportunity for them. And I think it's worked well for Kansas City.
Do you recall conversations about these community investments and about this philanthropy and gifts when you were younger? Was this something that they talked about, like, in front of you and made you a part of?
They did. And, they tried to instill in their four children, my three siblings and myself, the importance of giving back, whether you're, well off or not. Each of us has a responsibility to look out for others, and my parents believe strongly, and again, they taught us that you're really happier when you take the focus off of yourself and put it on other people, and what better way to do that than through, charitable acts.
One of the most notable impacts your mother has had and your organization in the Kansas City area, of course, was the Block Building at the Kansas City Museum. Why was art so important to your mother?
You know, my parents, it's sort of funny, when they built their house, going decades ago, they felt like they needed pretty pictures, as my dad would say, pretty pictures on the wall. And one thing led to another, and they at that time fell in love with Impressionist art. And, of course, the prices back then were nothing like they are today. My dad often says, he couldn't afford to buy these paintings today. But they were able to collect some really wonderful pieces of art. And I think, as Laura mentioned, they will eventually go to the Nelson Atkins Museum.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother have a kind of, other than Impressionists, so was there something that she felt very passionately about, like providing art to the city? What was that about?
She liked arts in general, not just the visual arts, but also the performing arts. She loved the ballet, for example, and that was really her main interest was the arts. And, my parents really enjoyed collecting Impressionist art, and it was always a real treat to see these beautiful paintings hung on the walls of their house.
And, I understand you have a meeting to go to in about like 20 seconds here, but just a last question. What do you hope your mother's legacy will be for Kansas City?
You know, I think with the recent announcement of the establishment of the Marion Bloch Neuroscience Institute at St. Luke's Hospital, which the family is hoping will become one of the premier neuroscience centers in the United States, we hope, you know, I hope that, you know, she'll be remembered as someone who cared first for her family and secondly for her community. And she was just a wonderful, loving, and I would underline the word loving, person.
Mm. Well, Tom Bloch, thank you so much for sharing your time and your mother's memory with us today on Central Standard.
Great to be with you. Thank you, Matt.
Take care. And another Kansas City philanthropist was Adele Hall, and she was, of course, a member of the Hall family, who, of course, owns Hallmark. Her background also, she grew up in the Midwest, right, Laura?
She grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and a lifelong Huskers fan, we might note. And, of course, she married Donald Hall. She grew up in a very traditional family where her folks were involved in a number of community organizations. She was Phi Beta Kappa at the University of Nebraska with a degree in elementary education. But when she married the love of her life, Donald Hall, she went on to become the powerhouse philanthropic leader in Kansas City that we all knew her to be at the time of her untimely death.
And I was reading, she was an incredibly hard worker. I mean, she graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Nebraska, and just some of the things, the boards she was on.
She was on a number of boards, but I think what distinguished her career as a philanthropist is not just her ability to chair a board, of which she did many, but the other things that she did. She had an equal commitment as just a community member, a fundraiser, and she was in the trenches folding envelopes and stamping invitations just like the rank and file.
Well, we're lucky enough to have a caller come in, Steve Doyle. Steve, welcome to Central Standard. Good morning.
Hello, Matt. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Steve. Steve, of course, is a public relations director at Hallmark Cards.
Steve, thank you. Thank you for being here. And can you tell me how you knew Adele and what kind of impact she had on your life?
Well, I had the great good fortune to work with Adele on community boards that we served on together, and then through countless company-related activities that she was associated with. And then, like many others in the community, I watched sort of her quiet grace as she touched lots of parts of the community. So I knew her for about 40 years, and she was a very special lady.
Some of the contributions she made were all across the board. Can you give me examples of some of the ones that you think have made the biggest impact on our community?
Well, I think if Mrs. Hall had a calling, that calling probably was children and the care and nurturing of children. And that's where I believe you'll see some of her strongest impact. You were right. It was a very broad range. But she had a deep love for Children's Mercy Hospital and other organizations that supported children. I think you know that the hospital has just recently named the campus here the Adele Hall Campus of Children's Mercy Hospital. And to Laura's point, she chaired that board, but she also rocked babies in the nursery. She had an ability to bring people together, lay a strong foundation, and then I think bring about lasting contributions to the community.
And can you give me a sense of what kind of person she was? I never had the pleasure of meeting her. It seemed like she was just such a, you know, a type A kind of person, just such an incredibly hard, focused worker. Is that a fair assumption to make just by looking at her resume on paper?
Well, she was an enormously hardworking person, but I think one of the things that distinguished Adele was her smile and the way that she had with people. You could be in a crowded room, and when Adele Hall was speaking to you, you felt as if you were the only person in the room. She was focused on you. She was interested in what you had to say or what you wanted to contribute, and after her passing, the comments that we heard from people who were interestingly would characterize themselves as ordinary people who had a great memory of an interaction with Adele. And Adele would never have thought that anyone was an ordinary person. She just thought that every person had something to contribute and worth, and was always interested in what they had to say.
I think it's notable, Steve. I just want to add to you that you're saying she didn't think she was an ordinary person. She was extremely humble and compromising, and she worked with all kinds of people doing all kinds of things, sort of belying that toughness that she had to get things done.
Well, I want to – oh, sorry. Go on, Steve.
I would say, indeed, that she was a gentle spirit, but was a pretty powerful catalyst in bringing people together.
And on a number of national boards, we should say.
Yeah, not just a Kansas City influential mover, but throughout the metro and the nation. Well, Steve Dole, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Central Standard this morning and sharing your memories and experiences about Adele Hall.
My pleasure to talk about a great lady.
And Laura Ziegler, you're the community engagement reporter for Hear Us at Kansas City KCUR. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Matt.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our look back on some of those who've passed away this year. And we want to hear from you. Who's passed away this year that maybe didn't make the headlines but has made an impact in our community? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Today we're talking about some of the people who've passed away in Kansas City this year who've made an impact on us. And we turn now to politics. We also noted the passing of Congressman Ike Skelton. Ike Skelton represented Missouri's 4th Congressional District for over 30 years. Yesterday, KCUR's Dan Verbeck spoke with Larry McCullen about the life of Ike Skelton and filed this report.
He was Ike, always Ike, not Isaac Newton Skelton. When the future congressman became friends with Larry McMullen at University of Missouri, undergraduates together and then law school, friends from 1952 to the day Skelton died of pneumonia in late October at age 81. He was elected to Congress and reelected again and again and again. A military hawk, he was pro-gun, anti-abortion, and a moderate to conservative Democrat throughout. Politics were in Skelton through all the years he lived in Lexington, the town from which he was buried. Colleagues from Congress were at his memorial service. There was a condolence message to his family from President Obama. And old fraternity brothers, McMullen among them. We talked about the life and times of Ike Skelton yesterday.
He remained interested in the best things of life, the comradeship, friendship, and you know, although he had weighty matters, legislative matters on his mind all the time, he could park that and call you up and have a 30-minute conversation. It made you feel just like you were back in the fraternity house.
What was the quality or qualities of Ike Skelton that allowed him to be able to be reelected more than a dozen times from a very conservative part of a state like Missouri?
The quality is his character. His constituents knew that he cared deeply about the welfare of his district, but more importantly about their welfare. And as you point out, it was this Republican district. When it came to Ike Skelton for, 34 years, they didn't care what party he was in. They knew that Ike was their friend. They knew he had their best interests at heart. And, of course, he went to some pains to let them know that. He came back from Washington often, went to pancake suppers in Stover, Missouri, and other very small places, and remained friends with those people. And it wasn't show. It wasn't he wasn't calculating. He did it because that's the way he felt about them. There's one sentence that, for me, characterizes Ike better than any other single sentence, and that is, Ike Skelton's a man who never forgot where he came from. He never forgot that he came from Lafayette County in Lexington, Missouri. And all of his surrounding constituents, they knew that. And they, when they voted for him, they were voting for a friend because he was their friend. That's my belief, and I think that was a secret of why he was sent back to Washington for 17 terms, I believe.
Would he have been dismayed at the state of affairs in Washington with the strict, harsh divide that seems to negate compromise these days?
Yes, absolutely. He was dismayed by it. After he retired from Congress, he became my law partner, and he had his office two doors from me, and we talked about it often. He went so far as to say, I don't really know if I would want to be there now. He said, that's not the way I do things. And if you look at his record, he was a master of compromise. He knew that he had to give away something to get something. And if it was important enough to get, then he'd find something that he could give that would enable him to get it. I believe that was the art of politics and the art of governing under our system. So the answer to your question is, yes, he would be dismayed.
Larry McMullen, thank you so much for reminiscing about Ike Skelton, your boyhood and longtime lifetime friend.
That was KCUR's Dan Verbeck reporting on the life of Ike Skelton, who passed away this October. And today we're looking at some of the people who passed away who've made dramatic impacts in our community. And in just a few minutes, we'll be taking your calls about those who made an impact in our community, but perhaps didn't make the headlines. If you know somebody who needs to be remembered, call in at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. But first, we're just going to take a quick few minutes here to look at the life of legendary broadcaster and KCUR host Walt Bodine. Joining me by phone to celebrate Walt's life is KCUR's Pitch's food critic, Charles Ferruzza. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing better. I got to tell you, though, Matthew, that I'm recovering from a car accident I had a couple weeks ago, recovering pretty slowly, but it has made me realize what a great fighter Walt was. I mean, he never missed a day of work, and he had so many physical ailments that I think would stop anybody. And, you know, the loss of his vision, the loss of his, you know, his ability to walk, but it never stopped him. He was a pro to the...
That was definitely one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which was, you know, he did lose his vision and you know, his mobility. But my impression from everybody here at KCUR and everyone I've ever talked to about Walt was that he was never a very bitter person or didn't let them sour him. Is that true?
I knew him for, almost 30 years. And if there was any bitterness, I never, ever saw it. He just accepted life as it was. And I'll tell you, he was the most diplomatic and gracious person I've ever met.
Oh, my. And do you have an example of some of his humor? I understand he was quite the humorous fellow here at KCUR.
He was extremely funny. He had a great sense of humor. If you could make Walt laugh, you knew that you were, you know, that you had succeeded greatly. But what I really admired so much about him is the respect he had for the callers who would call in on the show. He felt that they were far more important than any of his guests, far more important than anything he had to say, and he was always so unflappable and gracious with them.
Mm-hmm. And you're also the host of Central Standard's Food Critic Show on every other Friday. And were there any things you learned from him or by listening to him or watching him host that you try to instill?
I think I've learned everything in my life from Walt Bodine. You know, to be sensitive and to be, you know, to have your ears open for, you know, for any turn in the conversation that might lead it to maybe a better place.
And I understand he was also like just an incredibly hard worker. You mentioned he didn't miss a day of, you know, according to you, he didn't miss a day of work.
But rarely he did that I remember.
And he also was known for having at least two jobs more than he, you know, than the typical one. Do you think he was just gifted, and that's what like made it so effortless for him to take on all those responsibilities, or was it just like his insane work ethic?
I think both. You know, you have to remember Walt grew up as the only child of a pharmacist who had an all-night drugstore, And Walt was working professionally, whether he was, you know, running errands for his father or working behind the soda counter. He was working from the time he was a very, very little boy. He had an incredible work ethic.
Hmm. And last question here, Charles. Unlike some people who we've featured, you know, they didn't necessarily build a building or statues. But what do you hope Walt Bodine's legacy will be for Kansas City?
Well, I like to think that he mentored a whole generation, maybe several generations, of really good reporters and really good media people. And I think that anyone in the media out there listening would agree that Walt was a very patient and very kind teacher. And you could get a master's degree in media relations just by being around him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining us this morning to share your memories and experiences about Walt Bodine. And he's certainly missed, and we continue to talk about him here at the station even today. That was KCUR's food critic, Charles Ferruzza. Thanks, Charles. And again, this is not an exclusive or extensive list. It's just a few of the many people in the region who've made an impact. And we want to hear from you, who passed away this year, who's made an impact in your community, but didn't necessarily make the headlines. Share your story with us by calling 816-235-2888 or tweeting us at KCURCST. Joining us now to discuss how we pass from life to death and remembrance is Jennifer Shantz. She's the grief support specialist at Kansas City Hospice. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Matthew.
Medicine has done an incredible thing for humanity. It's prolonged our life, but it's also protracted and extended our living through illnesses. And that's kind of forced us to confront grief in a way that is even different from maybe 50 years ago. Can you talk to me about the process of like anticipatory grieving that so many of us have to go through today?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we tend to think of grief as something that occurs after a loss. And yet, really, the grief process starts from earlier on in the process. So any time that a person is diagnosed, for example, with a terminal illness, there is the grief process that begins, the letting go process, the anticipating what life will be like without that person in it.
And do you find that, like, is it typical that people begin to feel like some sense of guilt about that? Like the person hasn't left, but you're already starting to think about your life
mm-hmm.
without them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because there's that sense that that somehow that's a betrayal to be thinking about that. And yet really grieving is such a balance between holding on and letting go. And yeah, so we're constantly sort of like a teeter-totter trying to find a good balance between those two.
And can you speak to me about some of the people that, you know, that how we typically anticipate the grief process to go? Like how do people usually conceptualize what this will be like?
Mm-hmm. I think we tend to think of grief as sort of like the flu, like there's a starting and a stopping point to it. And so there's that misconception that grief will somehow end or that there is a time frame associated with that, when it actually it's a process. And mm-hmm. so it ebbs and tends to ebb and flow.
And so what do you mean by like ebb and flow? Like, for example, you're caring for someone who's in the process of passing. How do you, what are you typically going through that? And then when they pass away, what happens typically?
Well, when I say ebb and flow, I guess what I mean is we tend to move in and out of the pain mm-hmm. of grief, and so there's that idea that. When you're grieving, you're just saturated with grief. And yet the reality is that we tend to sort of move into the pain and then move out of the pain. And that may be a little bit where the guilt comes into that you talked about, that life goes on. And we find ourselves, for example, you know, sweeping the floor in the middle of some kind of a crisis and then wondering, how can we do that? How can we keep functioning when all this is going on, when something so terrible is going on, mm-hmm. and yet mm-hmm. I'm having to continue to function?
And, you know, I find that when I remember my friends or family that have passed away, I'm not necessarily actively grieving, but I still grieve when I think of them, when I miss them.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you, like, is there such a thing as, like, getting over the loss? Like, do you ever get over it?
we like to say that you don't get over it, you get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, if you think again about how grief is not like the flu with a start and stop, another way of looking at that is that the only way to really be, quote, over, end quote, grief would be to stop caring about that person. And you continue to care about that person after they're gone. Your relationship doesn't end.
Sorry, go on.
No, just that it continues, just as your bond with that person continues.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and our guest is Jennifer Shantz. She's a grief support specialist at Kansas City Hospice. And we're talking about the grieving process and how to celebrate those we've loved. Kansas City, who's passed away this year who hasn't made headlines but has made an impact in your community? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or emailing us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And joining us now from Leavenworth is Linda Johnson. Linda, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello.
Good morning. And there was someone that you thought we should recognize this morning, and you wanted to share with us, correct?
Yes, that's right. I would like us to recognize Hans Uffelmann. He was a leader, or perhaps even the epitome of a leader, of bioethics in Kansas City. He was one of the three founders of Midwest Bioethics Center, that will be celebrating their 30th year in existence. They're now the Center for Practical Bioethics. He taught ethics at UMKC and at Truman Children's, was on call 24 hours a day, and took very, very seriously the importance of teaching all healthcare professionals about the important role of ethics in healthcare.
What, did you happen to know him, Linda?
Oh, yes. I worked at Midwest Bioethics Center and worked with Hans a great deal. There was an ethics consortium that took members from the ethics committees of every healthcare institution in Kansas, and we would meet each month to share ethical dilemmas. And Hans was very influential in helping all of us learn how to be better at applying ethics to healthcare.
And was he more of kind of a philosopher or scientist or a little bit of both?
More of a philosopher.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And any particular moment that you'd like to share about him on air?
Oh, gosh. No, I don't think there is a special moment. He had a sudden massive stroke on December the 5th and died 2 days later on the 7th. So I was listening to your last caller about anticipatory grief. And while he was up in years, and none of us expect to live forever, we really didn't have much of a chance to mourn him in advance. So there will be a memorial service held in the not too distant future to celebrate his life, but that hasn't happened yet.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it.
That's fine. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And so as Linda was saying, Jennifer, you don't always work with just people in long-term disease care, mm-hmm. End-of-life care. You also deal with people who have passed away rather suddenly. Is there a difference in the way you approach handling grief counseling for the long-term ill versus for sudden losses like Linda mm-hmm. was referring to?
That's a good question. I think with sudden losses, as your last caller was explaining, there is less of an opportunity to say goodbye and to say those things that we want to say to people that we care about, like, I love you, or to ask for forgiveness. Mm. And so with a sudden or a traumatic death, there's also maybe a little more element of shock, mm-hmm. which is often present anyway, and a little more element of numbness that needs to be worked through. Just that process of believing that person is really gone, and then helping the person even after the loss or the death to be able to talk to that person in a sense, and to be able to say goodbye or say the things that we wish we could have said when they were alive.
Mm. Rebecca has who's calling in from South Kansas City. She also has another question for you. Rebecca, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you.
And your question for Jennifer?
Well, my grandfather recently passed away, and he was actually at Kansas City Hospice House, but he had a massive stroke and survived for 40 days, but unconscious. He had like 10 rebleeds. And we had to basically make the decision to move him to the hospice house and to stop feeding him through his PEG tube.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very traumatic because he was very healthy and he didn't have a stroke due to high blood pressure. He had a stroke due to a congenital defect. And so our family is just really struggling because we kind of feel like, you know, we pulled the PEG tube, so we kind of did it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, how do we move forward?
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, is this pretty typical of somebody in Rebecca's circumstance?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And those end-of-life decisions are huge, and they're complex. They're never really black and white, and there's a lot of responsibility in them. And, you know, I would encourage you, particularly since he was in Kansas City Hospice House, to access grief support services, and you can ask for me by name or anyone in grief support department, and we'd be happy to talk with you. But I feel your pain and your that sense of responsibility that can just be huge.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And I want to kind of, we have just a minute left here, but I want to move us also into how we begin to remember people. Remembrance is probably one of the most important and biggest parts of getting through grief.
Mm-hmm.
How do you suggest people, celebrate life, hold on mm-hmm. to, there is sadness, but there's also a celebration. How do you suggest people begin to do that?
Well, I think you just said that, and this show is a piece of that too. That any time we talk about the person who died, we honor them, and when we share those memories and those stories, and we remember to remember, we keep that person with us. We keep connection with them and keep them alive in a sense.
Well, Jennifer Shantz, grief support specialist at Kansas City Hospice, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matthew.
Really appreciate it. And that is Central Standard for today. Can't find my credits here. You can stream us live on KCUR.org, and you can listen to our podcast anytime at KCUR.org. Our program was produced today by Sylvia Maria Gross, myself, and all the KCUR news team. Thank you so much. You really helped out today. Up to Date is next with a conversation regarding the best and most impactful deals in Kansas City this year. And we will be with you tomorrow with a look at molecular mixology for the holidays. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. This is KCUR.